This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Pet Sematary, a novel by Stephen King, read by Michael C. Hall.
For Kirby McCauley. A note from Stephen King. When I'm asked, as I frequently am, what I consider to be the most frightening book I've ever written, the answer I give comes easily and with no hesitation: Pet Sematary. It may not be the one that scares readers the most. Based on the mail, I'd guess the one that does that is probably The Shining. But the fear bone, like the funny bone, is located in different places on different people. All I know is that Pet Sematary is the one I put away in a drawer, thinking I had finally gone too far. Time suggests that I had not, at least in terms of what the public would accept, but certainly I had gone too far in terms of my own personal feelings. Put simply, I was horrified by what I had written and the conclusions I'd drawn. I've told the story of how the book came to be written before, but I guess I can tell it one more time. Last time pays for all. In the late 70s, I was invited to spend a year at my alma mater, the University of Maine, as the writer in residence, and also teach a class in the literature of the fantastic. My lecture notes for that course formed the spine of Danse Macabre, which was published a year or two later. My wife and I rented a house in Arrington, about 12 miles from the campus. It was a wonderful house in a wonderful rural Maine town. The only problem was the road we lived on. It was very busy. A lot of the traffic consisting of heavy tanker trucks from the chemical plant down the road. Julio De Sanctis, who owned the store across the road from us, told me early on that my wife and I wanted to keep a close watch on our children and on any pets our children might have. That road has used up a lot of animals, Julio said, a phrase that made its way into the story. And the proof of how many animals the road had used up was in the woods beyond our rented house. A path led up through the neighboring field to a little pet cemetery in the woods. Only the sign on the tree just outside this charming little makeshift graveyard read P-E-T-S-E-M-A-T-A-R-Y. This phrase did more than just make it into the book. It became the title. There were dogs and cats buried up there, a few birds, even a goat. Our daughter, who was 8 or so at the time, had a cat named Smucky. And not long after we moved into the Arrington house, I found Smucky dead on the lawn of a house across the road. The newest animal Route 5 had used up, it seemed, was my daughter's beloved pet. We buried Smucky in the pet cemetery. My daughter made the grave marker, which read, "Smucky, he was obedient." Smucky wasn't in the least obedient, of course. He was a cat, for heaven's sake. All seemed to be well until that night, when I heard a thumping from the garage, accompanied by weeping and popping sounds like small firecrackers. I went out to investigate and found my daughter, furious and beautiful in her grief. She had found several sheets of that blistered packing material in which fragile objects are sometimes shipped. She was jumping up and down on this, popping the blisters and yelling, "He was my cat! Let God have his own cat! Smucky was my cat!" Such anger, I think, is the sanest first response to grief that a thinking, feeling human being can have, and I've always loved her for that defiant cry, "Let God have his own cat." Right on, beautiful, right on. Our youngest son, then less than 2 years old, had only learned to walk, but already he was practicing his running skills. On a day not long after Smucky's demise, while we were out in the neighboring yard fooling around with a kite, our toddler took it into his head to go running toward the road. I ran after him, and damned if I couldn't hear one of those Chinbro trucks coming, Orinco in the novel. Either I caught him and pulled him down, or he tripped on his own. To this day, I'm not entirely sure which. When you're really scared, your memory often blanks out. All I know for sure is that he is still fine and well and in his young manhood. But a part of my mind has never escaped from that gruesome what if. Suppose I hadn't caught him. Or suppose he had fallen in the middle of the road instead of on the edge of it. I think you can see why I found the book which rose out of these incidents so distressing. I simply took existing elements and threw in that one terrible what if. Put another way, I found myself not just thinking the unthinkable, but writing it down. There was no writing space in the Orrington house, but there was an empty room in Julio's store, and it was there that I wrote Pet Cemetery. On a day-by-day basis, I enjoyed the work, and I knew I was telling a hot story, one that engaged my attention and would engage the attention of readers. But when you're working day by day, you're not seeing the forest, you're only counting trees. When I finished, I let the book rest 6 weeks, which is my way of working, and then I read it over. I found the result so startling and so gruesome that I put the book in a drawer, thinking it would never be published. Not in my lifetime, anyway. That it was published was a case of mere circumstance. I had ended my relationship with Doubleday, the publisher of my early books, but I owed them a final novel before accounts could be closed completely. I only had one in hand that wasn't spoken for, and that one was Pet Cemetery. I talked it over with my wife, who is my best counselor when I'm not sure how to proceed, and she told me that I should go ahead and publish the book. She thought it was good. Awful, but too good not to be read. My early editor at Doubleday, Bill Thompson, had moved on by then, to Everest House, as a matter of fact. It was Bill who first suggested, then edited and published Danse Macabre. So I sent the book to Sam Vaughan, who was one of the editorial giants of the time. It was Sam who made the final decision. He wanted to do the book. He edited it himself, giving particular attention to the book's conclusion, and his input turned a good book into an even better one. I've always been grateful to him for his inspired blue pencil, and I've never been sorry that I did the book, although in many ways I still find it distressing and problematic. I'm particularly uneasy about the book's most resonant line, spoken by Lewis Creed's elderly neighbor, Judd. "Sometimes, Lewis," Judd says, "dead is better." I hope with all my heart that that is not true, and yet within the nightmarish context of Pet Cemetery, it seems to be. And it may be okay. Perhaps sometimes dead is better is grief's last lesson. The one we get to when we finally tire of jumping up and down on the plastic blisters and crying out for God to get his own cat or his own child and leave ours alone. That lesson suggests that in the end, we can only find peace in our human lives by accepting the will of the universe. That may sound like corny New Age crap, but the alternative looks to me like a darkness too awful for such mortal creatures as us to bear. September 20th, 2000. Part 1. The Pet Cemetery. Jesus said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may awake him out of his sleep." Then the disciples looked at each other, and some smiled because they did not know Jesus had spoken in a figure. "Lord, if he sleeps, he shall do well." So then Jesus spoke to them more plainly. "Lazarus is dead, yes. Nevertheless, let us go to him." John's Gospel. Paraphrase. 1. Lewis Creed, who had lost his father at 3 and who had never known a grandfather, never expected to find a father as he entered his middle age, but that was exactly what happened. Although he called this man a friend, as a grown man must do when he finds the man who should have been his father relatively late in life. He met this man on the evening he and his wife and his 2 children moved into the big white frame house in Ludlow. Winston Churchill moved in with them. Church was his daughter Eileen's cat. The search committee at the university had moved slowly. The hunt for a house within commuting distance of the university had been hair-raising, and by the time they neared the place where he believed the house to be, all the landmarks are right, like the astrological signs the night before Caesar was assassinated, Lewis thought morbidly. They were all tired and tense and on edge. Gage was cutting teeth and fussed almost ceaselessly. He would not sleep, no matter how much Rachel sang to him. She offered him the breast, even though it was off his schedule. Gage knew his dining schedule as well as she, better maybe, and he promptly bit her with his new teeth. Rachel, still not entirely sure about this move to Maine from Chicago, where she had lived her whole life, burst into tears. Eileen promptly joined her. In the back of the station wagon, Church continued to pace restlessly, as he had done for the last 3 days it had taken them to drive here from Chicago. His yowling from the cat kennel had been bad, but his restless pacing after they finally gave up and set him free in the car had been almost as unnerving. Lewis himself felt a little like crying. A wild but not unattractive idea suddenly came to him. He would suggest that they go back to Bangor for something to eat while they waited for the moving van, and when his three hostages to fortune got out, he would floor the accelerator and drive away without so much as a look back, foot to the mat, the wagon's huge four-barrel carburetor gobbling expensive gasoline. He would drive south, all the way to Orlando, Florida, where he would get a job at Disney World as a medic, under a new name. But before he hit the turnpike, big old 95 southbound, he would stop by the side of the road and put the fucking cat out, too. Then they rounded a final curve, and there was the house that only he had seen up until now. He had flown out and looked at each of the seven possibles they had picked from photos once the position at the University of Maine was solidly his, and this was the one he had chosen. A big old New England colonial, but newly sided and insulated. The heating costs, while horrible enough, were not out of line in terms of consumption. Three big rooms downstairs, four more up, a long shed that might be converted to more rooms later on. All of it surrounded by a luxuriant sprawl of lawn, lushly green even in this August heat. Beyond the house was a large field for the children to play in. And beyond the field were woods that went on damn near forever. The property abutted state lands, the realtor had explained, and there would be no development in the foreseeable future. The remains of the Mi'kmaq Indian tribe had laid claim to nearly 8,000 acres in Ludlow and in the towns east of Ludlow, and the complicated litigation involving the federal government as well as that of the state might stretch into the next century. Rachel stopped crying abruptly. She sat up. Is that? That's it, Lewis said. He felt apprehensive. No, he felt scared. In fact, he felt terrified. He had mortgaged 12 years of their lives for this. It wouldn't be paid off until Eileen was 17. He swallowed. What do you think?
I think it's beautiful, Rachel said.
And that was a huge weight off his chest and off his mind. She wasn't kidding, he saw. It was in the way she was looking at it as they turned into the asphalted driveway that curved around to the shed and back, her eyes sweeping the blank windows, her mind already ticking away at such matters as curtains and oilcloth for the cupboards, and God knew what else.
Daddy?
Ellie said from the back seat. She had stopped crying as well. Even Gage had stopped fussing. Lewis savored the silence. What, love? Her eyes, brown under the darkish blonde hair in the rearview mirror, also surveyed the house, the lawn, the roof of another house off to the left in the distance, and the big field stretching up to the woods.
Is this home?
It's going to be, honey, he said.
Hooray!
She shouted, almost taking his ear off. And Lewis, who could sometimes become very irritated with Ellie, decided he didn't care if he ever clapped an eye on Disney World in Orlando. He parked in front of the shed and turned off the wagon's motor. The engine ticked. In the silence, which seemed very big after Chicago and the bustle of State Street and the Loop, a bird sang sweetly in the late afternoon.
Home, Rachel said softly, still looking at the house.
Home, Gage said complacently on her lap. Lewis and Rachel stared at each other. In the rearview mirror, Eileen's eyes widened.
Did he? Was that?
They all spoke together, then all laughed together.
Gage took no notice. He only continued to suck his thumb. He had been saying Ma for almost a month now, and he had taken a stab or two at something that might have been Da, or only wishful thinking on Lewis's part. But this, either by accident or imitation, had been a real word. Home. Lewis plucked Gage from his wife's lap and hugged him. That was how they came to Ludlow. 2. In Lewis Creed's memory, that one moment always held a magical quality. Partly, perhaps, because it really was magical, but mostly because the rest of the evening was so wild. In the next 3 hours, neither peace nor magic made an appearance. Lewis had stored the house keys away, neatly. He was a neat and methodical man, was Lewis Creed. In a small manila envelope, which he had labeled Ludlow House, keys received June 29th. He had put the keys away in the Fairlane's glove compartment. He was absolutely sure of that. Now they weren't there. While he hunted for them, growing increasingly irritated, Rachel hoisted Gage onto her hip and followed Eileen over to the tree in the field. He was checking under the seats for the third time when his daughter screamed and then began to cry. "Lewis!" Rachel called. "She's cut herself!" Eileen had fallen from the tire swing and hit a rock with her knee. The cut was shallow, but she was screaming like someone who had just lost a leg, Lewis thought, a bit ungenerously. He glanced at the house across the road where a light burned in the living room. "All right, Ellie," he said. "That's enough. Those people over there will think someone's being murdered."
"But it hurts!"
Lewis struggled with his temper and went silently back to the wagon. The keys were gone, but the first aid kit was still in the glove compartment. He got it and came back. When Ellie saw it, she began to scream louder than ever.
"No, not the stingy stuff! I don't want the stingy stuff! Daddy, no!"
"Eileen, it's just mercurochrome, and it doesn't sting. Be a big girl," Rachel said. "It's just..."
"No, no, 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 no!"
"You want to stop that or your ass will sting," Lewis said. "She's tired, Lou," Rachel said quietly. "Yeah, I know the feeling. Hold her leg out." Rachel put Gage down and held Eileen's leg, which Lewis painted with mercurochrome in spite of her increasingly hysterical wails. "Someone just came out on the porch of that house across the street," Rachel said. She picked Gage up. He had started to crawl away through the grass. "Wonderful," Lewis muttered.
"Lou, she's tired, I know."
He capped the mercurochrome and looked grimly at his daughter. "There. And it really didn't hurt a bit. Fess up, Ellie."
"It does! It does hurt! It hurt!"
His hand itched to slap her, and he grabbed his leg hard.
"Did you find the keys?" Rachel asked.
"Not yet," Lewis said, snapping the first aid kit closed and getting up. Gage began to scream. He was not fussing or crying, but really screaming, writhing in Rachel's arms.
"What's wrong with him?"
Rachel cried, thrusting him almost blindly at Lewis. It was, he supposed, one of the advantages of having married a doctor. You could shove the kid at your husband whenever the kid seemed to be dying.
"Lewis, what's..."
The baby was grabbing frantically at his neck, screaming wildly. Lewis flipped him over and saw an angry white knob rising on the side of Gage's neck, and there was also something on the strap of his jumper, something fuzzy, squirming weakly. Eileen, who had become quieter, began to scream again.
"Bee! Bee! Bee!"
She jumped back, tripped over the same protruding rock on which she had already come a cropper, sat down hard, and began to cry again in mingled pain, surprise, and fear. "I'm going crazy," Lewis thought wonderingly.
"Whee!"
"Do something, Lewis. Can't you do something?"
"Got to get the stinger out," a voice behind them drawled. "That's the ticket. Get the stinger out and put some baking soda on it. Bump go down."
But the voice was so thick with Downeast accent that for a moment Lewis's tired, confused mind refused to translate the dialect.
"Got to get the stinger out and put some baking soda on it. It'll go down."
He turned and saw an old man of perhaps 70, a hale and healthy 70, standing there on the grass. He wore a bibawls over a blue chambray shirt that showed his thickly folded and wrinkled neck. His face was sunburned and he was smoking an unfiltered cigarette. As Lewis looked at him, the old man pinched the cigarette out between his thumb and forefinger and pocketed it neatly. He held out his hands and smiled crookedly,
a smile Lewis liked at once, and he was not a man who took to people. "Not to tell you your business, Doc," he said. And that was how Lewis met Judson Crandall, the man who should have been his father. 3. He had watched them arrive from across the street and had come across to see if he could help when it seemed they were in a bit of a tight, as he put it. While Lewis held the baby on his shoulder, Crandall stepped near, looking at the swelling on Gage's neck, and reached out with one blocky, twisted hand. Rachel opened her mouth to protest. His hand looked terribly clumsy and almost as big as Gage's head. But before she could say a word, the old man's fingers had made a single, decisive movement, as apt and deft as the fingers of a man walking cards across his knuckles or sending coins into conjurer's limbo, and the stinger lay in his palm.
"Biggin," he remarked. "No prize winner, but it'd do for a ribbon, I guess."
Lewis burst out laughing. Crandall regarded him with that crooked smile and said,
"Yeah, corker, ain't she?"
"What did he say, Mommy?"
Eileen asked. And then Rachel burst out laughing, too. Of course, it was terribly impolite, but somehow it was okay. Crandall pulled out a deck of Chesterfield Kings, poked one into the seamed corner of his mouth, nodded at them pleasantly as they laughed. Even Gage was chortling now, in spite of the swelling of the bee sting, and popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail.
"The old have their tricks," Lewis thought. "Small ones, but some of them are good ones."
He stopped laughing and held out the hand that wasn't supporting Gage's bottom, Gage's decidedly damp bottom.
"I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Judd Crandall," he said and shook. "You're the doc, I guess."
"Yes, Lewis Creed. This is my wife Rachel, my daughter Ellie, and the kid with the bee sting is Gage.
Nice to know all of you." "I didn't mean to laugh. That is, we didn't mean to laugh. It's just that we're a little tired."
That, the understatement of it, caused him to giggle again. He felt totally exhausted. Crandall nodded.
"Course you are," he said. He glanced at Rachel. "Why don't you take your little boy and your daughter over to the house for a minute, Mrs. Creed? We can put some baking soda on a wash rag and cool that off some. My wife would like to say hello, too. She don't get out too much. Arthritis got bad the last 2 or 3 years."
Rachel glanced at Lewis, who nodded. "That would be very kind of you, Mr. Crandall."
"Oh, I just answered the Judd," he said.
There was a sudden loud honk, a motor winding down. And then the big blue moving van was turning, lumbering, into the driveway.
"Oh, Christ, and I don't know where the keys are," Lewis said.
"That's okay," Crandall said. "I got a set. Mr. and Mrs. Cleveland, they that lived here before you, gave me a set, oh, must have been 14, 15 years ago. They lived here a long time. Joan Cleveland was my wife's best friend. She died 2 years ago. Bill went to that old folks' apartment complex over in Orrington. I'll bring 'em back over. They belong to you now, anyway."
"You're very kind, Mr. Crandall," Rachel said.
"Not at all," he said. "Looking forward to having young'uns around again. Except that the sound of this, as exotic to their Midwestern ears as a foreign language, was yowens. You just want to watch 'em around the road, Mrs. Creed. Lots of big trucks on that road."
Now there was the sound of slamming doors as the moving men hopped out of the cab and came toward them. Ellie had wandered away a little, and now she said,
"Daddy, what's this?"
Lewis, who had started to meet the moving men, glanced back. At the edge of the field where the lawn stopped and high summer grass took over, a path about 4 feet wide had been cut, smooth and close. It wound up the hill, curved through a low stand of bushes and a copse of birches, and out of sight.
"Looks like a path of some kind," Lewis said.
"Oh, yeah," Crandall said, smiling. "Tell you about it sometime, missy. You want to come over and we'll fix your baby brother up?"
"Sure,"
Ellie said, and then added with a certain hopefulness,
"Does baking soda sting?"
4. Crandall brought back the keys, but by then Lewis found his set.
There was a space at the top of the glove compartment, and the small envelope had slipped down into the wiring. He fished it out and let the movers in. Crandall gave him the extra set. They were on an old, tarnished fob. Lewis thanked him and slipped them absently into his pocket, watching the movers take in boxes and dressers and bureaus and all the other things they had collected over the 10 years of their marriage. Seeing them this way, out of their accustomed places, diminished them. Just a bunch of stuff in boxes, he thought, and suddenly he felt sad and depressed. He guessed he was feeling what people call homesickness.
Uprooted and transplanted, Crandall said, suddenly beside him, and Lewis jumped a little.
You sound like you know the feeling, he said.
No, actually, I don't.
Crandall lit a cigarette. Pop went the match, flaring brightly in the first early evening shadows.
My dad built that house across the way, brought his wife there, and she was taken with child there, and that child was me, born in the very year 1900.
That makes you
83, Crandall said,
and Lewis was mildly relieved that he didn't add years young, a phrase he cordially detested. You look a lot younger than that.
Crandall shrugged. Well, anyway, I've always lived there. I joined up when we fought the Great War, but the closest I got to Europe was Bayonne, New Jersey. Nasty place. Even in 1917, it was a nasty place. I was just as glad to come back here. Got married to my Norma, put in my time on the railroad, and here we still are. But I've seen a lot of life right here in Ludlow. I sure have.
The moving men stopped by the shed entrance, holding the box springs that went under the big double bed he and Rachel shared.
"Where do you want this, Mr. Creed?"
"Upstairs. Just a minute. I'll show you." He started toward them, then paused for a moment and glanced back at Crandall.
"You go on," Crandall said, smiling. "I'll see how your folks are making out. Send them back over and get out of your way. But moving in's mighty thirsty work. I usually sit out on my porch about 9 and have a couple of beers. In warm weather, I like to watch the night come on. Sometimes Norma joins me. You come over if you're a mind."
"Well, maybe I will,"
Lewis said, not intending to at all. The next thing would be an informal and free diagnosis of Norma's arthritis on the porch. He liked Crandall, liked his crooked grin, his offhand way of talking, his Yankee accent, which was not hard-edged at all, but so soft it was almost a drawl. A good man, Lewis thought, but doctors became leery of people fast. It was unfortunate, but sooner or later, even your best friends wanted medical advice. And with old people, there was no end to it. "But don't look for me or stay up. We've had a hell of a day."
"Just so long as you know you don't need no engraved invitation," Crandall said.
And there was something in the man's crooked grin that made Lewis feel that Crandall knew exactly what Lewis was thinking. He watched the old guy for a moment before joining the movers. Crandall walked straight and easily, like a man of 60 instead of over 80. Lewis felt that first faint tug of affection. 5. By 9 o'clock the movers were gone. Ellie and Gage, both exhausted, were sleeping in their new rooms, Gage in his crib, Ellie on a mattress on the floor surrounded by a foothill of boxes, her billions of Crayolas, whole, broken, and blunted, her Sesame Street posters, her picture books, her clothes, heaven knew what else. And of course Church was with her, also sleeping and growling rustily in the back of his throat. That rusty growl seemed the closest the big Tom could come to purring. Rachel had prowled the house restlessly with Gage in her arms earlier, second-guessing the places where Lewis had told the movers to leave things, getting them to rearrange, change, or restack. Lewis had not lost their check. It was still in his breast pocket, along with 5 $10 bills he had put aside for a tip. When the van was finally emptied, he handed both the check and the cash over, nodded at their thanks, signed the bill of receipt, and stood on the porch watching them head back to their big truck. He supposed they would probably stop over in Bangor and have a few beers to lay the dust. A couple of beers would go down well right now. That made him think of Judd Crandall again. He and Rachel sat at the kitchen table, and he saw the circles under her eyes. You, he said, go to bed. Doctor's orders? She asked, smiling a little. Yeah. Okay, she said, standing. I'm beat, and Gage is apt to be up in the night. You coming? He hesitated. I don't think so just yet. That old fellow across the street, road, you call it a road out in the country. Or if you're Judson Crandall, I guess you call it a rud. Okay, across the rud. He invited me over for a beer. I think I'm going to take him up on it. I'm tired, but I'm too jived up to sleep. Rachel smiled. You'll end up getting Norma Crandall to tell you where it hurts and what kind of mattress she sleeps on. Lewis laughed, thinking how funny and scary it was, the way wives could read their husbands' minds after a while. He was here when we needed him, he said. I can do him a favor, I guess. Barter system? He shrugged, unwilling and unsure how to tell her that he had taken a liking to Crandall on short notice. How's his wife? Very sweet, Rachel said. Gage sat on her lap. I was surprised because he's had a hard day. And, you know, he doesn't take very well to new people on short notice under the best of circumstances. And she had a dolly she let Eileen play with. How bad would you say her arthritis is? Quite bad. In a wheelchair? No, but she walks very slowly, and her fingers... Rachel held her own slim fingers up and hooked them into claws to demonstrate. Lewis nodded. Anyway, don't be late, Lou. I get the creeps in strange houses. It won't be strange for long, Lewis said and kissed her. 6. Lewis came back later feeling small. No one asked him to examine Norma Crandall. When he crossed the street, Rudd, he reminded himself, smiling, the lady had already retired for the night. Judd was a vague silhouette behind the screens of the enclosed porch. There was the comfortable squeak of a rocker on old linoleum. Lewis knocked on the screen door, which rattled companionably against its frame. Crandall's cigarette glowed like a large, peaceable firefly in the summer darkness. From a radio, low, came the voice of a Red Sox game, and all of it gave Lewis Creed the oddest feeling of coming home. Doc, Crandall said. I thought that was you. Hope you meant it about the beer, Lewis said, coming in. All about beer, I never lie, Crandall said. A man who lies about beer makes enemies. Sit down, Doc. I put an extra couple on ice just in case. The porch was long and narrow, furnished with rattan chairs and sofas. Lewis sank into one and was surprised at how comfortable it was. At his left hand was a tin pail filled with ice cubes and a few cans of Black Label. He took one. Thank you, he said, and opened it. The first two swallows hit his throat like a blessing. More than welcome, Crandall said. I hope your time here will be a happy one, Doc. Amen, Lewis said. Say, if you want crackers or something, I could get some. I got a wedge of rat that's just about right. A wedge of what? Rat cheese. Crandall sounded faintly amused. Thanks, but just the beer will do me.
Well, then we'll just let her go.
Crandall belched contentedly. Your wife gone to bed? Lewis asked, wondering why he was opening the door like this.
Yeah, sometimes she stays up, sometimes she don't.
Her arthritis is quite painful, isn't it?
You ever see a case it wasn't?
Crandall asked. Lewis shook his head.
I guess it's tolerable, Crandall said. She don't complain much. She's a good old girl, my Norma.
There was a great and simple weight of affection in his voice. Out on Route 15, a tanker truck droned by, one so big and long that for a moment Lewis couldn't see his house across the road. Written on the side, just visible in the last light, was the word Orinco.
One hell of a big truck, Lewis commented. Orinco's near Orrington, Crandall said. Chemical fertilizer factory. They come and go all right. And the oil tankers and the dump trucks and people who go to work in Bangor, Mabrua, and come home at night. He shook his head.
That's the one thing about Ludlow I don't like anymore. That frigging road. No peace from it. They go all day and all night. Wake Norma up sometimes. They'll wake me up sometimes, and I sleep like a goddamn log.
Lewis, who thought this strange Maine landscape almost eerily quiet after the constant roar of Chicago, only nodded his head.
One day soon the Arabs will pull the plug and they'll be able to grow African violets right down the yellow line, Crandall said.
You might be right. Lewis tilted his can back and was surprised to find it empty.
Crandall laughed.
You just grab yourself one to grow on, Doc.
Lewis hesitated and then said, All right, but just one more. I have to be getting back.
Sure you do. Ain't moving a bitch.
It is, Lewis agreed. And then for a time they were silent. The silence was a comfortable one, as if they had known each other for a long time. This was a feeling about which Lewis had read in books, but which he had never experienced until now. He felt ashamed of his casual thoughts about free medical advice earlier. On the road, a semi roared by, its running lights twinkling like earth stars.
That's one mean road, all right, Crandall repeated thoughtfully, almost vaguely, and then turned to Lewis.
There was a peculiar little smile on his seamed mouth. He poked a Chesterfield into one corner of the smile and popped a match with his thumbnail.
You remember the path there, that your little girl commented on?
For a moment, Lewis didn't. Ellie had commented on a whole catalog of things before finally collapsing for the night. Then he did remember. That wide mown patch, winding up through the copse of trees and over the hill.
Yes, I do. You promised to tell her about it sometime.
I did and I will, Crandall said. That path goes up into the woods about a mile and a half. The local kids around Route 15 and Middle Drive keep it nice because they use it. Kids come and go. There's a lot more moving around here than there used to be when I was a boy. Then you picked a place out and stuck to it. But they seem to tell each other, and every spring a bunch of them mows that path. They keep it nice all the summer long. Not all of the adults in town know it's there. A lot of them do, of course, but not all, not by a long chalk. But all of the kids do. I'd bet on it.
Know what's there?
The pet cemetery, Crandall said.
Pet cemetery? Lewis repeated, bemused.
It's not as odd as it probably sounds, Crandall said, smoking and rocking. It's the rud. It uses up a lot of animals, that rud does. Dogs and cats, mostly, but that ain't all. One of those big Orinco trucks run down the pet raccoon the Ryder children used to keep. That was back, Christ, must have been in 73, maybe earlier, before the state made keeping a coon or even a denatured skunk illegal, anyway.
Why did they do that?
Rabies, Crandall said. Lot of rabies in Maine now. There was a big old St. Bernard went rabid downstate a couple of years ago and killed 4 people. That was a hell of a thing. Dog hadn't had his shots. If those foolish people had seen that dog had had its shots, it never would have happened. But a coon or a skunk, you can vaccinate it twice a year, and still it don't always take. But that coon the Ryder boys had, they was what the old-timers used to call a sweet coon. It'd waddle right up to you, gory, wasn't he fat, and lick your face like a dog. Their dad even paid a vet to spay him and declaw him. That must have cost him a country fortune. Ryder, he worked for IBM in Bangor. They went out to Colorado 5 years ago, or maybe it was 6. Funny to think of those two, almost old enough to drive. Were they broken up over that coon? I guess they were. Maddie Ryder cried so long his mom got scared and wanted to take him to the doctor. I suppose he's over it now, but they never forget. When a good animal gets run down in the rud, a kid never forgets.
Lewis's mind turned to Ellie as he had last seen her tonight, fast asleep with Church purring rustily on the foot of the mattress. My daughter's got a cat, he said. Winston Churchill. We call him Church for short.
Do they climb when he walks?
I beg your pardon? Lewis had no idea what he was talking about.
He still got his balls, or has he been fixed?
No, Lewis said. No, he hasn't been fixed. In fact, there had been some trouble over that back in Chicago. Rachel had wanted to get Church spayed, had even made the appointment with the vet. Lewis canceled it. Even now, he wasn't really sure why. It wasn't anything as simple or as stupid as equating his masculinity with that of his daughter's Tom, nor even his resentment at the idea that Church would have to be castrated so the fat housewife next door wouldn't need to be troubled with twisting down the lids of her plastic garbage cans. Those things had been part of it, but most of it had been a vague but strong feeling that it would destroy something in Church that he himself valued, that it would put out the go-to-hell look in the cat's green eyes. Finally, he had pointed out to Rachel that they were moving to the country and it shouldn't be a problem. Now here was Judson Crandall pointing out that part of country living in Ludlow consisted of dealing with Route 15, and asked him if the cat was fixed.
Try a little irony, Dr. Creed. It's good for your blood.
I'd get him fixed, Crandall said, crushing his smoke between his thumb and forefinger. A fixed cat don't tend to wander as much, but if it's all the time crossing back and forth, its luck will run out, and it'll end up there with the Ryder Kid's coon, and little Timmy Dessler's cocker spaniel and Mrs. Bradley's parakeet. Not that the parakeet got run over in the rut, you understand. It just went feet up one day.
I'll take it under advisement, Lewis said.
You do that, Crandall said and stood up. How's that beer doing? I believe I'll go in for a slice of old Mr. Rat after all.
Pierre's gone, Lewis said, also standing. And I ought to go, too. Big day tomorrow.
Starting in at the university?
Lewis nodded. The kids don't come back for 2 weeks, but by then I ought to know what I'm doing, don't you think?
Yeah, if you don't know where the pills are, I guess you'll have trouble.
Crandall offered his hand and Lewis shook it, mindful again of the fact that old bones pained easily.
Come on over any evening, he said. Want you to meet my Norma. Think she'd enjoy you.
I'll do that, Lewis said. Nice to meet you, Judd.
Same goes both ways. You'll settle in. May even stay a while.
I hope we do. Lewis walked down the crazy paved path to the shoulder of the road and had to pause while yet another truck, this one followed by a line of 5 cars headed in the direction of Bucksport, passed by. Then, raising his hand in a short salute, he crossed the street. Road, he reminded himself again, and let himself into his new house. It was quiet with the sounds of sleep. Ellie appeared not to have moved at all, and Gage was still in his crib, sleeping in typical Gage fashion, spread-eagled on his back, a bottle within easy reach. Lewis paused there looking in at his son, his heart abruptly filling with a love for the boy so strong that it seemed almost dangerous. He supposed part of it was simply homesickness for all the familiar Chicago places and Chicago faces that were now gone, erased so efficiently by the miles that they might never have been at all.
There's a lot more moving around than there used to be. Used to be you picked a place out and stuck to it.
There was some truth in that. He went to his son, and because there was no one there to see him do it, not even Rachel, he kissed his fingers, and then pressed them lightly and briefly to Gage's cheek through the bars of the crib. Gage clucked and turned over on his side.
Sleep well, baby, Lewis said.
He undressed quietly and slipped into his half of the bed that was, for now, just 2 single mattresses pushed together on the floor. He felt the strain of the day beginning to pass. Rachel didn't stir. Unpacked boxes bulked ghostly in the room. Just before sleep, Lewis hiked himself up on one elbow and looked out the window. Their room was at the front of the house, and he could look across the road at the Crandall place. It was too dark to see shapes. On a moonlit night it would not have been, but he could see the cigarette ember over there. Still up, he thought. He'll maybe be up for a long time. The old sleep poorly. Perhaps they stand watch. Against what? Lewis was thinking about that when he slipped into sleep. He dreamed he was in Disney World,
driving a bright white van with a red cross on the side. Gage was beside him, and in the dream, Gage was at least 10 years old. Church was on the white van's dashboard, looking at Lewis with his bright green eyes, and out on Main Street by the 1890s train station, Mickey Mouse was shaking hands with the children clustered around him, his big white cartoon gloves swallowing their small, trusting hands. 7. The next 2 weeks were busy ones for the family. Little by little, Lewis's new job began to shake down for him. How it would be when 10,000 students, many of them drug and liquor abusers, some afflicted with social diseases, some anxious about grades or depressed about leaving home for the first time, a dozen of them, girls mostly, anorexic, how it would be when all of them converged on the campus at once would be something else again. And while Lewis began getting a handle on his job as head of university medical services, Rachel began to get a handle on the house. Gage was busy taking the bumps and spills that went with getting used to his new environment, and for a while his nighttime schedule was badly out of whack, but by the middle of their second week in Ludlow, he had begun to sleep through again. Only Ellie, with the prospect of beginning kindergarten in a new place before her, seemed always overexcited and on a hair trigger. She was apt to go into prolonged giggling fits, or periods of almost menopausal depression, or temper tantrums at the drop of a word. Rachel said Ellie would get over it when she saw that school was not the great red devil she had made it out to be in her own mind, and Lewis thought Rachel was right. Most of the time, Ellie was what she had always been. A dear. His evening beer or two with Judd Crandall became something of a habit. Around the time Gage began sleeping through again, Lewis began bringing his own six-pack over every second or third night. He met Norma Crandall, a sweetly pleasant woman who had rheumatoid arthritis, filthy old rheumatoid arthritis, which kills so much of what could be good in the old ages of men and women who are otherwise healthy. But her attitude was good. She would not surrender to the pain. There would be no white flags. Let it take her if it could. Lewis thought she might have another 5 to 7 years productive, if not terribly comfortable, years ahead of her. Going completely against his own established customs, he examined her at his own instigation, inventoried the prescriptions her own doctor had given her, and found them to be completely in order. He felt a nagging disappointment that there was nothing else he could do or suggest for her, but her Dr. Weybridge had things as under control as they were ever going to be for Norma Crandall, barring some sudden breakthrough, which was possible but not to be counted upon. You learned to accept, or you ended up in a small room writing letters home with Crayolas. Rachel liked her, and they had sealed their friendship by exchanging recipes the way small boys trade baseball cards, beginning with Norma Crandall's deep-dish apple pie for Rachel's beef stroganoff. Norma was taken with both of the Creed children, particularly with Ellie, who she said was going to be an old-time beauty. At least, Lewis told Rachel that night in bed, Norma hadn't said Ellie was going to grow into a real sweet coon. Rachel laughed so hard she broke explosive wind, and then both of them laughed so long and loudly that they woke up Gage in the next room. The first day of kindergarten arrived. Lewis, who felt pretty well in control of the infirmary and the medical support facilities now, took the day off. Besides, the infirmary was currently dead empty. The last patient, a summer student who had broken her leg on the student union steps, had been discharged a week before. He stood on the lawn beside Rachel with Gage in his arms as the big yellow bus made the turn from Middle Drive and lumbered to a stop in front of their house. The doors at the front folded open. The babble and squawk of many children drifted out on the mild September air. Ellie cast a strange, vulnerable glance back over her shoulder, as if to ask them if there might not yet be time to abort this inevitable process, and perhaps what she saw in the faces of her parents convinced her that the time was gone, and everything which would follow this day was simply inevitable, like the progress of Norma Crandall's arthritis. She turned away from them and mounted the steps of the bus. The doors folded shut with a gasp of dragon's breath. The bus pulled away. Rachel burst into tears. Don't, for Christ's sake, Lewis said. He wasn't crying, only damn near. It's only half a day.
Half a day is bad enough, Rachel answered in a scolding voice and began to cry harder.
Lewis held her and Gage slipped an arm comfortably around each parent's neck. When Rachel cried, Gage usually cried too, but not this time. He has us to himself, Lewis thought, and he damn well knows it. They waited with some trepidation for Ellie to return, drinking too much coffee, speculating on how it was going for her. Lewis went out into the back room that was going to be his study and messed about idly, moving papers from one place to another but not doing much else. Rachel began lunch absurdly early. When the phone rang at 10:15, Rachel raced for it and answered with a breathless, "Hello?" before it could ring a second time. Lewis stood in the doorway between his office and the kitchen, sure it would be Ellie's teacher telling them that she had decided Ellie couldn't hack it. The stomach of public education had found her indigestible and was spitting her back. But it was only Norma Crandall, calling to tell them that Judd had picked the last of the corn, and they were welcome to a dozen ears if they wanted it. Lewis went over with a shopping bag and scolded Judd for not letting him help pick it.
"Most of it ain't worth a tin shit anyway," Judd said.
"You'll kindly spare that talk when I'm around," Norma said. She came out on the porch with iced tea on an antique Coca-Cola tray.
"Sorry, my love."
"He ain't sorry a bit," Norma said to Lewis, and sat down with a wince.
"Saw Ellie got on the bus," Judd said, lighting a Chesterfield.
"She'll be fine," Norma said. "They almost always are."
Almost, Lewis thought morbidly. But Ellie was fine. She came home at noon, smiling and sunny, her blue first day of school dress belling gracefully around her scabbed shins, and there was a new scrape on one knee to marvel over. A picture of what might have been two children, or perhaps two walking gantries in one hand, one shoe untied, one ribbon missing from her hair, shouting,
"We sang Old MacDonald! Mommy! Daddy! We sang Old MacDonald! Same one as in the Carstairs Street School!"
Rachel glanced over at Lewis, who was sitting in the window seat with Gage on his lap. The baby was almost asleep. There was something sad in Rachel's glance, and although she looked away quickly, Lewis felt a moment of terrible panic. "We're really going to get old," he thought. "It's really true. No one's going to make an exception for us. She's on her way, and so are we." Ellie ran over to him, trying to show him her picture, her new scrape, and tell him about Old MacDonald and Mrs. Berryman all at the same time. Church was twining in and out between her legs, purring loudly, and Ellie was somehow, almost miraculously, not tripping over him. "Shh," Lewis said and kissed her. Gage had gone to sleep, unmindful of all the excitement. "Just let me put the baby to bed and then I'll listen to everything." He took Gage up the stairs, walking through hot, slanting September sunshine, and as he reached the landing, such a premonition of horror and darkness struck him that he stopped cold, and looked around in surprise, wondering what could possibly have come over him. He held the baby tighter, almost clutching him, and Gage stirred uncomfortably. Lewis's arms and back had broken out in great rashes of goose flesh. "What's wrong?" he wondered, confused and frightened. His heart was racing. His scalp felt cool and abruptly too small to cover his skull. He could feel the surge of adrenaline behind his eyes. Human eyes really did bug out when fear was extreme, he knew. They did not just widen, but actually bulged, as blood pressure climbed and the hydrostatic pressure of the cranial fluids increased. "What the hell is it? Ghosts? Christ, it really feels as if something just brushed by me in this hallway. Something I almost saw." Downstairs, the screen door whacked against its frame. Lewis Creed jumped, almost screamed, and then laughed. It was simply one of those psychological cold pockets people sometimes passed through. No more, no less. A momentary fugue. They happened. That was all. What had Scrooge said to the ghost of Jacob Marley? "You may be no more than an underdone bit of potato,
there's more gravy than grave to you. And that was more correct, physiologically as well as psychologically, than Charles Dickens had probably known. There were no ghosts, at least not in his experience. He had pronounced 24 people dead in his career and had never once felt the passage of a soul. He took Gage into his room and laid him in his crib. As he pulled the blanket up over his son, though, a shudder twisted up his back, and he thought suddenly of his Uncle Carl's showroom. No new cars there, no televisions with all the modern features, no dishwashers with glass fronts so you could watch the magical sudsing action. Only boxes with their lids up, a carefully hidden spotlight over each. His father's brother was an undertaker.
Good God, what gave you the horrors? Let it go. Dump it.
He kissed his son and went down to listen to Ellie tell about her first day at the big kid school. 8. That Saturday, after Ellie had completed her first week of school and just before the college kids came back to campus, Judd Crandall came across the road and walked over to where the Creed family sat on their lawn. Ellie had gotten off her bike and was drinking a glass of iced tea. Gage was crawling in the grass, examining bugs, perhaps even eating a few. Gage was not particular where his protein came from. "Judd," Lewis said, getting up, "let me get you a chair."
"No need."
Judd was wearing jeans, an open-throated work shirt, and a pair of green boots. He looked at Ellie.
"You still want to see where yon path goes, Ellie?"
"Yes,"
Ellie said, getting up immediately. Her eyes sparkled.
"George Buck at school told me it was the pet cemetery, and I told Mommy, but she said to wait for you because you knew where it was."
"I do, too," Judd said. "If it's okay with your folks, we'll take us a stroll up there. You'll want a pair of boots, though. Ground's a bit squishy in places."
Ellie rushed into the house. Judd looked after her with amused affection.
"Maybe you'd like to come too, Lewis."
"I would," Lewis said. He looked at Rachel. "You want to come, honey?"
"What about Gage? I thought it was a mile."
"I'll put him in the jerry pack."
Rachel laughed. "Okay, but it's your back, mister." They started off 10 minutes later, all of them but Gage wearing boots. Gage was sitting up in the jerry pack and looking at everything over Lewis's shoulder, goggle-eyed. Ellie ranged ahead constantly, chasing butterflies and picking flowers. The grass in the back field was almost waist-high, and now there was goldenrod, that late summer gossip which comes to tattle on autumn every year. But there was no autumn in the air today. Today the sun was still all August, although calendar August was almost 2 weeks gone. By the time they had reached the top of the first hill, walking strung out along the mown path, there were big patches of sweat under Lewis's arms. Judd paused. At first, Lewis thought it might be because the old man was winded. Then he saw the view that had opened out behind them.
"Pretty up here," Judd said, putting a piece of timothy grass between his teeth.
Lewis thought he had just heard the quintessential Yankee understatement.
"It's gorgeous," Rachel breathed and turned to Lewis almost accusingly. "How come you didn't tell me about this?"
"Because I didn't know it was here," Lewis said, and was a little ashamed. They were still on their own property. He had just never found time to climb the hill in the back of the house until today. Ellie had been a good way ahead. Now she came back, also gazing with frank wonder. Church padded at her heels. The hill was not a high one, but it did not need to be. To the east, heavy woods blocked any view, but looking this way, west, the land fell away in a golden and dozy late summer dream. Everything was still, hazed, silent. There was not even an Orinco tanker on the highway to break the quiet. It was the river valley they were looking into, of course. The Penobscot, where loggers had once floated their timber from the northeast down to Bangor and Derry. But they were south of Bangor and a bit north of Derry here. The river flowed wide and peacefully, as if in its own deep dream. Lewis could make out Hampton and Winterport on the far side,
and over here he fancied he could trace the black, river-paralleling snake of Route 15 nearly all the way to Bucksport. They looked over the river, its lush hem of trees, the roads, the fields, the spire of the north.